Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Soldiers of Cinema podcast. Today, it is me and my lovely co-host. I'm going back to the lovely. I'm always going back to lovely Clark Coffee. Why don't you introduce yourself, Clark?
Now, you can tell we haven't done this in a while. And that's
it's
okay.
It's been, what, 2 months?
It's
now?
Been a couple months, and I'm happy that we're back, but that was awesome. Mm-hmm. That was awesome. No, yeah. well, thank you. I mean, look, I'm not going to turn down lovely, you know? Yeah. I appreciate that. So thank you. Thank you.
No. Anytime. But today, speaking of lovely, although I don't know if it's a word that I would use to describe this movie, perhaps the king of DIY filmmaking, we're talking about 1974's Texas Chainsaw Massacre, The Texas Chainsaw Massacre by Tobe Hooper, directed by.
And for sure. I mean, not just DIY filmmaking, but I mean, horror filmmaking,
yes,
obviously. This is a landmark film for independent film, but in the horror genre, I mean, this, you know, you'd be hard pressed, I think. I mean, you know, some people might say Halloween, you know, there's, Night of the Living Dead, but I mean, you know, as far as kind of the modern, you know, slasher, the films that really, of course, became extremely prominent and successful in the 80s, I think, where the slasher really had its heyday. You know, this film was the precursor to all of that.
What happened was true. The most bizarre and brutal series of crimes in America. This is the movie that is just as real, just as close.
Crazy! You gotta make us stop!
Just as terrifying as being there.
Please.
Even if one of them survives, what will be left? The Texas Chainsaw Massacre. After you stop screaming, you'll start talking about it.
And
it's your choice. Yeah. So what made you choose it? Like, what was your...
Well, okay, good. Yeah. So right. It was my choice this time. So let's see. This film was released in 74. I was born in 76. I don't remember when I first saw this film, but I cannot remember a time when I didn't know about it. Mm-hmm. That it had kind of already permeated the culture. I mean, you know, for example, just some examples. Like, I remember when I was young, like really young, I had an Atari, and I remember one of my favorite games on the Atari was Texas Chainsaw Massacre. There was actually an Atari game, right? And you run around, you literally play Leatherface, and you run around, and you, it's horrible, but you, like, you know, chop people up with your chainsaw. You chase them around a little, like, field or whatever on the game, and you chop people, you kill people with a chainsaw. Of course, it's just little blocks of pixels, you know, so it's not necessarily that gruesome. But, you know, so I remember that. I mean, I remember, like, my parents talking about it, you know. It just seemed like it kind of already permeated the culture. And, it, you know, before I even have, like, a specific recollection of having seen the film, I remember just it was, like, there, right? And, you know, maybe some of this is because, you know, my parents loved watching, like, genre films. And that was, I think I've talked about that, where they would have people over and watch genre films. My dad was, you know, renting movies from, like, local movie stores, you know, way before they kind of became mainstream. We had VCRs going way, way, way back. So that was just kind of, like, part of my consciousness. But I love horror films. And if you were to ask me, what do I think it may be the most visceral film ever made in the horror genre? I think I would say Texas Chainsaw Massacre. I mean, the one word I could use to describe this that I think would, you know, if you forced me to use only one word, I'd be like visceral. I mean, there is like a visceralness to this film. And we'll talk about kind of all the elements that kind of combine to do that. But it's just such a profoundly effective film for what it's trying to do. Also, it's a great example of an extremely effective DIY film. You know, it's for its time, it was low budget. Now, it's not, you know, it was like, maybe around 120 numbers, kind of from 80 to 140 or so, but it's all kind of split the difference, about 120K to complete the film. I mean, you're getting up to like, you know, $800,000+ in today's money. So, you know, I just made a movie for, you know, like $60,000. So, you know, $800,000+ is still a lot of money.
I could take it.
Yeah. You know, but it was, you know, it's also too, I keep going on and on here and I'll let you chime in, but it's also, I picked it because, you know, I love exploitation films and genre films. And we've talked about some of those, like Mad Max and Mad Max 2, for example, The Road Warrior. I think this is such an interesting example of, like, you know, I mean, this is like the definition of genre exploitation film, and that it transcended that, like that it broke through that, was so extremely successful, not just in its time, but that it has such a lasting cultural impact. And, you know, my guess is that for many people at this time, this is probably the first like real exploitation film many people ever saw. You know?
So I
think it's a extremely interesting film and in many, many aspects, and it's a film that I absolutely love. So there you go.
Yeah. So I agree with everything you said there.
That's good to know, because we can't have disagreements.
Absolutely. No, I don't remember the first time I saw this movie, but I do know for sure that it has influenced me in my own work, like greatly. Especially my early stuff. It's interesting because it's also one of those movies that, you know, when I watch it, kind of in that league of like Silence of the Lambs, where there's a lot of things I find about it that are very funny and I think are intentionally funny on the filmmaker's part.
For sure.
People, when I say that to them, who perhaps maybe aren't as familiar with it or something, are like, how do you find anything funny about that? Like, isn't it a horrible, like, gory, gruesome thing? And
My gosh, there's humor throughout this whole thing.
Absolutely.
We definitely want to talk about that, so I'm going to put a pin in it. But there's no question that there's a lot of humor in this. And, you know, I think, again, I put a pin in it, but it's cheese. Toby goes on to do Chainsaw 2, and he even ups that, you know, he ups the ante on that. Well, we could talk about that a little bit better, but continue, sir.
But yeah, no, I do think it's really interesting that it always stuck out to me as this movie that was, like you said, I mean, I actually recall having many conversations when I was coming up with ideas for shorts and features and things like that with friends about it, and using that specific word too, as visceral, as describing this movie as visceral, and saying, I want to make what we're making as visceral as this and as kinetic and, you know, forward moving, because this movie just never stops in an incredibly like well-paced way, though. I mean, that the pacing is, I know that there's people that say that it just never has time to breathe, but I think that totally puts you in the you know, seat with these characters. And I also think another interesting thing is that people describe this movie as, you know, having tons of gore and blood and things like that, but it's actually not that bloody of a movie. Like, there's not a lot of it is just left up to the imagination. You don't actually see blood spray. Of course there's blood in it, but not nearly as, you know, blood, buckets of blood being dumped over on actors and things like that as people might expect there to be.
Well, that's I mean, there's just so many different fun things to talk about this movie, but, you know, I don't remember the first time I saw it either. And, you know, usually we kind of start off with like our personal experience with the film. What's strange is that, like, I really can't remember when I first saw this film, and I've seen it numerous times in my life. but I don't really have a recollection of like first time seeing it, you know? It just feels like it's always been there. But what you had just mentioned, that there's so much less gore than you think, right? And I remember, it's been years since I've seen the film. Obviously, I watched it just recently for this podcast. And I don't even know how long it's been since I've seen the film, maybe 6, 7, 8 years or something like that since I'd last seen it. But in my mind, right, it's just this like fever dream of insane gore or something. You know what I mean? It's like of insanity and, mm-hmm. and death. And in my mind, it's just burned into my brain that it's this like just insanely gory movie. And I'm watching it right now. And not even close. It's like there's almost no gore. Now there's violence that's happening for sure. There is violence that's happening, but it's either from a distance, or it's, you know, we cut to a reverse and you
or
don't actually see.
Or it's concealed in some way. Yeah.
It's concealed. It's hidden, right? But my goodness, is that effective? And you know, I think we've obviously moved away from that a lot in horror films. You know, I think it was, you know, especially in the 80s, right? This was kind of the precursor. And I think people kept trying to that maybe filmmakers remembered this film being so much more, you know, gruesome than it was or graphic than it was. And actually like put that graphic gruesomeness into it, you know, and films really started to push the boundary on that. Right. We have some extraordinary practical special effects, but I almost feel like, you know, they missed the point. Because this film really conveys such a primal fear, but without, I mean, they were even shooting for, it's my understanding that Toby, the director, was shooting for PG.
Yes, he wanted it to be PG,
You know, which of course, I mean, I see you like, you're like, you're almost cracking up, you know, when you hear that. Like, oh, he was shooting for PG, what the hell are you talking about?
Yeah.
You can hardly imagine that this film would be PG. PG, but it's just, I mean, just from a filmmaking perspective, from a storytelling perspective, like, wow, how effective, you know?
Well, I also think that the constraints on budget and the technical constraints, I think they had, I mean, again, we'll get into the technical details in a bit, but, you know, shot on 16 millimeter and they had very few lights to work with and things like that. That kind of almost, I almost, you know, want to say like grindhouse DIY, like very... Like that look to the movie gives it, I think, so much of its feeling. And I think it's very obvious when you watch, you know, most of the sequels, the remakes and things like that, that have the sheen on them. Like I know the Michael Bay produced one that came out, I think, in 2004. And you lose a lot of the griminess when suddenly you're working with a huge budget. And, you know, you've got beautiful lenses and you don't have this, like, this feels so documentarian in its filmmaking style in a lot of ways. And of course, you know, it's not, it's not found footage.
And that's interesting, right? And that's interesting.
Yeah.
You mentioned that because, like, let's go, you know, right back to the beginning, right? I mean, you know, the film opens and it's got this long crawl that's narrated by... John Larroquette, which I think is hysterical.
And they got him because they wanted to sound like Orson Welles is the thing there.
Yeah. And I think, he does a great job. But I don't think I knew that until, you know, years and years and years and years later. But I think that's awesome. But you've got this crawl that basically sets this up as like a true story, right? I mean, that's kind of the takeaway. And we have what I think is maybe one of the most effective opening sequences of any movie ever. I feel like maybe... Fincher copied a little bit of this in a certain way for Seven. I feel like a little, and it kind of extrapolated on it, but you've got this, you know, this flashbulb, right? This it's almost like crime photos being taken basically. And we've got these small glimpses into this, which makes it all the more scary, by the way. I mean, if you just had these images of these corpses, right? Just you know, lit and just were kind of like scanning through them, they'd be nowhere near as terrifying. But you've just got these brief glimpses and then you're left, you know, it's just left to your imagination.
Yeah, these decomposing bodies. Yeah.
These decomposing bodies, just these pictures of like a boot with like a, you know, semi-skeletal foot or, you know, and it's just, wow, how effective. And we go to these images of the sun, they're like solar flares or these like coronal ejections or whatever you call it, you know, that are kind of almost abstracted, you know, I think you had mentioned, like, you didn't even know that's what it was, you know, for a while.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, what's amazing about those solar flare footage too is that it there's several points where it looks like out of the like those ejections that it looks like skulls.
Yeah.
And so I always just assumed that it was some sort of like ink work or like
totally
graphic design kind of work done.
Yeah.
And it's the sun. It's just a really, really, you know, affected version of like, you know, color processed right. version of that footage. Yeah.
But it sets this up, you know, it does such a great job, right? We have kind of the radio. I think we start, you know, with some kind of like radio news footage, but it's mm-hmm. all setting the stage for like this oppressive heat and weirdness, right? Like there's mm-hmm. this solar storm or there's like, you know, it's weird stuff in the air, you know, what's going on? And we open up on this really beautiful close up, and then we move away from these corpses that are kind of positioned and shaped on a monument in the cemetery, which we're going to come back to later. Mm-hmm. But you know, it's just you feel the heat, you feel the oppression. We hear these like this weird stuff going on, and it jumps right in and just. Really does an amazing job setting up an atmosphere. I'm hard pressed to find a better, you know, I mean, I'm still just like terrified by that sound, you know, in that opening sequence.
Yeah.
With, like,
that.
The, which you had discovered. What is this instrument?
Yeah.
Called?
So there's this famous instrument called a hydrophone. And if you're ever in the need to, for some reason, listen to some horror movie sound effects, just search on
Google
YouTube
that.
Or whatever, just search hydrophone horror instrument. And it's basically this bizarre kind of circular device with these like spindles coming
uh-huh.
off of it that
yep.
if you take a violin
spokes,
bow.
Almost like spokes.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Very similar. Yeah. And if you take a violin bow and you can rub it on the actual bow side of it uh-huh. and it'll make that those kind of long, like wah, like
Whee!
Weird sounds that they yeah. actually, I mean, it's been used so much that it even is used in the opening titles of E.T. where it's kind of that creepy, you know, alien
yeah.
sound. But then if you also take the backside of the bow and rub it along, you get those like echoey kind of like creepy.
It's wild.
Sounds like a fence being dragged along with a, you know, a stick or something. And
which is basically what it is.
Yeah. And so you hear that stuff, you hear those really, really bizarre kind of otherworldly, you can't pinpoint the instrument. Like if I didn't know what that was, I wouldn't be able to pinpoint what the instrument was.
No, I couldn't. Like it was such an otherworldly sound that mm-hmm. it just lent itself to, like, I can't place it, right? Like,
and that music is done by Toby Hooper himself with Wayne Bell, like the director himself, which I'll get into this a little bit later, but I actually, when I was doing a short film, I remember we decided to kind of take a similar approach where we just, neither of us are particularly musically inclined, the guy I was working with. And so instead we just took pots and pans and like rubbed them together and put a bunch of reverb on it. And then, you know, had just weird metallic scrapes and things like that and made the soundtrack out of that. And you can, especially for horror, do a surprising amount with
yeah.
sound effects like that and turn them into some sort of soundtrack or ambient noise where people just can't pinpoint it. And so they do a fantastic job with that.
I mean, I actually thought
so that scary.
Yeah, you're right. And it is extremely effective throughout this entire film. I honestly thought it was like some kind of strange process or distortion on an actual like old-fashioned like flash cube or something.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Is almost what, because I was like, I can't place this at all. And so, you know, my brain just kind of was like, well, it's like this looks like flashes. Okay, you know, maybe it's like a weird distorted like those old-fashioned flash cubes, you know, where there was actually like an explosion, you know, to create enough light, you know, to get a bright flash.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it's we meet all the characters in the van. And, I, you know, I'm not sure if this has been done before, but I feel like this film did a lot of things or brought a lot of things to kind of like, you know, such a to such a consciousness that now we see it all the time and we hardly even think of it. You know, it's like, okay, you know, you set up the kids like going on a road trip, you know, you've got the, like, you meet the creepy hitchhiker, you meet the, like, not quite sure if he's a good guy or a bad guy, what's going on, you know, the guy at the gas station, you know what I mean? It's like so many of these are tropes now.
Yeah.
And that it's, you know, it's like when you watch this film now, after the fact that it has influenced so many other horror movies that it's a little bit strange. But imagine watching this, you know, in 74. Maybe you're not exposed to a lot of exploitation or you know, films. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just... I can imagine so much of this would be surprising and shocking.
Well, especially, I mean, I can't quite remember the first time I saw the movie, but I know, like you said, everybody knows the Texas Chainsaw Massacre. Like it's like Psycho. Like you, there's no way that you don't know, if not the story, at least what it is.
Leatherface. Everybody knows Leatherface, a guy with a chainsaw.
So I can't imagine having seen this without any indication or any. I mean, again, nothing like this had been done before. The fact that again it feels so DIY and so low budget, even though again, like you said, $800,000 in today's money is not necessarily super, super low budget, but still, you can definitely feel that filmmaking.
All unknown actors. You've got all unknown actors, and so, which is great for this. And I think, you know, most horror films tend to follow this template, right? I mean, obviously, in part because so many horror films are low-budget films. That's kind of the nature of that. But it's so effective because it's like we don't know, like if somebody is a star, you have a sense, well, they're going to make it to the end of the film, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, it's kind of
even just understand, like your brain is subconsciously thinking this is a movie the whole time.
Yes, it's a movie, right? It's like, you know, because I think they put, you know, exactly. So, but this all unknowns, pretty normal people. So, and just, you're right. It's like the way it's shot. I mean, we're sitting in this van. It's actually moving. This is not a process shot. Now, most of the time, it's exposed in a manner that all the windows are blown out. But we actually do see, like, this is really moving. Like, this is actually a moving van. It's not a process shot. They're really driving down the road. And here's just a bunch of people talking. And the hitchhiker character that we, you know, kind of the first member of the family that we meet is like, so freaking creepy, dude. Mm-hmm. I'm like, still to this day, like, I had kind of forgotten about him because it's just, I think, like, the focus is on Leatherface and the family back at the house, but
he's so grimy
but what an effective, but I mean, it just, like, this weird conversation we're having about the slaughterhouse, right? And killing of animals, and how the, you know, this new gun, you know, they're talking about how they have these air guns now that are supposed to be a more humane way to kill cattle, and how he's like, you know, sad that this has come into being because it was so much better when they would kill cattle, you know, by hand manually with a sledgehammer, you know?
Yeah.
I'm like, oh my gosh. And it's just all these little details, like this weird pouch that he has that's made out of some weird little animal.
Yeah, it's like roadkill or something.
Like some roadkill or something, you know. And just this like super creepy, and the kind of the like, I forget this kind of birthmark he's got on his face. I think it's like a wine mark, or I forget exactly what you call it.
Yeah, it's like it's some sort of weird, it's a
wine stain birthmark.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yep. And it's just, it's like so effective. And it's not that it's like, you know, it's not necessarily like really well acted, I wouldn't say, personally. It's not really exceptionally well written. I mean, this dialogue is not exactly, you know, going to win any awards, but it's just so effective. Everything does kind of,
it all works. It kind of,
it all works, right? Where you're like, it's, everything is just kind of off. Everything is just kind of off kilter and weird, you know?
Well, and the other thing that I find quite incredible, not that it's, again, there's no like absolutely insanely well composed, well lit shots here from a technical standpoint.
Ooh, well, there's a couple. There's
some really great. I mean, that shot under the swing is always, obviously, that's legendary. And the stuff in the house, not to say that it doesn't look great. I think it all looks really good, but there's nothing, you know, they just had such a limited budget with lights that what I found out when I was watching it this time that I did not know was that the DP was like 23 when he shot this.
Right.
Like he had just come out of the University of Texas's
first film
department. And, you know, to And he was talking, I listened to the commentary, and one of the things that he says is that when they were shooting the van scene, that he was like, oh, I totally overexposed the film here. You know, that he was always really disappointed that the windows are all blown out. Mm-hmm. And then Toby Hooper sort of says, well, I always thought that you did that intentionally because it makes the whole scene feel so hot.
Like, yes,
it just
and it
feels
does.
Like it's, it feels oh. like they're sitting in an oven.
Yep,
and,
yep.
You know, it really, so all these kind of mistakes or I think amateur qualities are what lend the film to look so... So, like you said, exploitative and just like it's this grindhouse kind of low budget scraping together whatever they can to make. I mean, all the vehicles in the movies are like are in the film are you know crew vehicles. Like all, when they find that kind of shed of cars, they're all just like the grips and the you know electricians' cars sitting in there. And it does really. I think that's one of the reasons that you know this is really one of those. Not that there's a few of those movies, but there's it's. I would say that this is one of the pinnacle movies that just makes you kind of want to pick up a camera and go out and shoot something.
Yeah, doesn't it?
Like you just the filmmaking here is so fun and inventive, and it bleeds out of the screen where you can just feel these people making these decisions in a very good way. And it just the amount of times again that like watching this last night, you know, makes me want to grab my camera and go to some. Place and shoot a gory horror movie. You know, it just makes you really
well, and it shows you that you can, you can make it terrifying without having to have a huge budget for effects. I mean, this film is a great study, right? Like, if I were teaching a film class, and it was like, you know, how can I make a scary movie with a tiny budget. I don't have budget for gore. I don't have budget for special effects. I don't know how to do, you know, computer graphics. Don't have the budget for any of this stuff. I've got real minimal. I can buy like a couple gallons of fake blood, but that's about it. I mean, this is the film that I would show students to be like, you absolutely positively can make something terrifying and have no special effects, almost none. I mean, I can't think of a film that does it better. You know, and I think this kind of, you know, goes into a little bit of production design. Now, I think that's, you know, where they obviously film and, you know, stuff like I think film is probably a huge percentage of their budget here. But production design in this film is really amazing. I am always amazed when I watch this film again at how fun and inventive the production design is inside the family's house, you know, with Leatherface, everything from the masks that he wears. And I think there's three different masks. And, you know, if you're careful to watch, you'll see this is important that each mask kind of represents a different personality or character that Leatherface is playing in the family, a different role. But all of these like skeletons, these weird, you know, I don't even decorations, you know,
the chicken bones and the feathers on the ground and that.
Just all the stuff, you know, there's like a wall of, you know, when the first person falls victim to Leatherface, you know, he goes into the house and you see like through a door, there's all these animal skulls.
That stark red door or that wall.
Yeah, right? The stark red wall with all these animal skulls behind, you know, through this doorway. It's just so terrifying. I mean, even little details, there's like, and it could just be total happenstance. Like maybe this was just a furnace grate, but there's even like a grate on the floor, like right where he's killed, you know, hit with a sledgehammer. Mm-hmm. And I'm almost just like, oh my God, it's like a killing floor, right? It's like,
it looks like where you drain the blood. Yeah.
I mean, it's just, and who knows? Like I said, it could have just been total coincidence. Like that's a furnace grate or something, right? But, you know, old fashioned homes used to just have like a furnace in the crawl space and just one, you know, one hole where the heat came out of. But all of that stuff, I mean, it's just, and I've seen so many, like whether it's video games or other movies, you know, the table, right? They're at this dinner table and there's these weird, gross meats and there's meat everywhere in this film, you know?
Her chair is made of arms and.
Yeah. And there's like just all of this crazy stuff, just skins and bones is like so effective. I mean, it's so terrifying. But in a like really,
you can't look away.
It's hard to articulate. You know, here we are. I'm on a podcast. Like the whole point is to articulate things. But you know, often I find myself like discovering how I feel about things like in the moment. So bear with me. But it's even, you know, to try to articulate, right? I mean, you've got horror movies that are that are scary because they're about, you know, the unknown, like maybe, you know, xenophobia, like maybe alien or something, right? Like an unknown life form is out there. You have horror movies that are like body horror, right? About like the our own bodies kind of falling apart as we age, like The Fly, for example, mm-hmm. which we've done on this show. You know, you've got horror movies about, you know, like, you know, what's in the dark and, you know, the bad guy coming to your house and breaking in, the boogeyman kind of thing. I there is some element, I don't know what it is, like all this, you know, skins and bones and that it's like filled in this house. There's like death everywhere. I'm having a hard time to even articulate like exactly what kind of horror that is or mm-hmm. why it's so terrifying.
Well, it's I think one of the things is that it's bizarre in a lot of ways. Like I do remember one of the things that I do remember from the first time I watched it that is and again I don't remember the context I was watching it, I don't remember where I was, but I do very vividly remember being so taken aback by how brilliant the characterization of Leatherface is mm-hmm. in that he's not really a killer. He's like Mm-mm. this neurotic, like,
well, a child.
And he you know, the fact that after he kills I think the third guy that goes in, so
it's so horrible we don't know the characters' names,
and they're all just killed off, the third victim and he just goes over to the window and like looks out the window like, oh my god, are they gonna come back again?
Yeah,
like,
no, who's,
where are all
scene.
These people coming from? And it's this,
no, you're
it's
so
this
right
fantastic
it's
yeah
like, because it's like, I forget, I mean, maybe it's Kirk. I think Kirk is the name of the first character that goes in. He gets hit in the head with a hammer.
Yeah, Kirk
right?
is the first, which is, and Pam is the girl, the second girl.
Which is one
girl.
Of the best falls ever. I mean,
oh,
it's
yeah,
not,
and he starts shaking, yeah.
No, it's not even a stuntman. I mean, the way he, like, twists around and just drops almost as if it's, like, greater than gravity. It's like... he's being like pulled that, like, you know, the hit was
the
so,
hammer forces him
it's
into
like
the ground.
Yeah, it's like the hammer was such an intense blow, like mm-hmm. it sells it so well that it's like forces him to the ground like harder than gravity.
And that
and
shaking
that,
too when he
and the
when it's
shaking
like it's, yeah.
is terrifying. Right. And then he's like drug off, and then I think it might be Pam who comes in later.
Yeah, Pam's
and
the that, second, yeah.
And that's where, you know, and this, I mean, still to this day, it's like, how many countless movies have done this, you know, since, but this, like, putting her on the hook. And of course we don't
well especially after showing her like she's got this bare-backed shirt
right.
on
yep
and
yep.
it's like, so you've got
you
this
know.
Like right before she walks in the house you see this perfect angle yep. of her back and it's
so
like
we
you
know
can see this, you know yep. and then yeah and then to have her oh
it's not like it's, you know, it's not like she's hanging from her clothes or a bra or something. It's like, no, that has gone into her flesh. Mm-hmm. We never see that in today's day and age. You know for sure there's a horror movie today, there would be an insert shot of like the hook piercing her, you know, yeah. or at least, you know, for sure. And this is just, I have to say, this is just more effective.
Yeah.
It's just more effective. I mean, it's, I literally feel the pain.
Well, you also
that.
Just, again, you get this, I mean, another just fantastic thing that they do is, again, like you mentioned earlier, building up this whole idea of like slaughtering the animals and all that mm-hmm. and how little we care about the well-being
yeah.
of the animals that are being slaughtered. And you get
some
that
people,
sense too
yeah.
when Pam, when I think that the third guy's name is Jerry. I think that's the
I think
name?
So
boyfriend.
Yes,
who
I think
goes
so.
In Sally's boyfriend, who goes in obviously before Sally to find him and
right.
leaves Sally and Franklin.
When he opens the
freezer mm-hmm. and Pam is still alive
yeah.
and she
yeah.
pulls up, and then rather than killing her, Leatherface just shuts the freezer again. Like, he doesn't
yep.
even, you know, put her out of her misery. He just
right.
is like, no, this is just, you know, meat that I'm
It's just meat. Yeah,
storing.
I want to keep it fresh. I got to yeah. keep it fresh till I'm ready to, like, chop it up, you know?
Yeah. And so that's, I think, the most brilliant stuff in horror films is this feeling of like, oh, that person's in there suffering and the movie's going to move on. And you just have
yeah.
that in the back of your mind.
Yeah.
You know, I remember feeling that very viscerally with Jaws too, of just this feeling of like these people that are getting eaten is it's like, oh my God, they're going under and they're still alive and all this stuff. And this movie definitely gave me the same feeling, that just this gut wrenching, like, disgust of, imagine being trapped in a freezer slowly freezing to death and just knowing, and especially just the fact that it locks from the outside
yeah.
and it's like they're not
uh-huh.
getting out of there.
No.
You know, so just this kind of thing is just so
you know,
like you said, visceral is such a perfect word. It's so visceral. It's like not, it takes no time to get into this stuff in such a brilliant way that just you really feel when Leatherface comes out and kills Jerry, and you hear that like yelp that he does before he gets hit in the head, you know, as the third victim. You yelp with him, like, because Leatherface just comes barreling out of that door, just like completely, again, neurotic. Like, where are these? Like, why? Where do they keep coming from? Why are they, you know, interrupting my day?
What's going on? Yeah,
and so that, and that's where that kind of dark humor comes in, where it's like, yeah, you feel, you sort of feel for Leatherface in some moments when he's all stressed out about this stuff, in this really bizarre way that you don't necessarily feel for like a Norman Bates or a Michael Myers or a Freddy or Jason, right?
Yeah, definitely not Michael Myers. I, at least in, you know,
and I think, you know, I think that that's one of the reasons that I've always, you know, not to compare the two because they are very different, but just to say that, like, that I think this is the ultimate horror movie in so many ways because of that, that it's doing all this stuff so differently that nothing's ever quite replicated it nearly as well as it you know, a lot of people have tried, but they always kind of miss something. There's that, like you said, there's that odd thing where when a film tries to, like the slashers in the 80s, when they kind of went all in on the violence, assuming that Texas Chainsaw also did that, but like you said, you never see the hook enter Pam's back. You never see all this stuff. It really does, again, just kind of make you realize how brilliant so much of the filmmaking was behind this movie.
Well, and even, you know, and even a so, and I think this is really key. You know, all these different choices, and the visceralness. One of the things I think about is obviously the importance of the chainsaw. First of all, we haven't even talked about the name, but the name is just so ridiculously brilliant. I mean, it's one of those like exploitation titles that's like, we're going to tell people exactly what they're going to see.
Yeah.
And I mean, there's like no way that you cannot have a visceral reaction to the Texas Chainsaw Massacre. You're like, what? And the choice of a chainsaw for a weapon, I think, is so vital. Now, I don't know if it had been done before this film, and maybe it had, but this has got to be the first film, though, that really brought this to, you know, mass public consciousness. But it is such a visceral weapon. It's, first of all, it's like everybody knows how, I mean, just the tiniest touch of a moving chainsaw is going to just tear your flesh apart, right? Yeah. It's moving, it's loud, the sound is violent, it's smoking, it's vibrating. It's like, you know, it's like, I just imagine, it's like I'm watching this film, you know, and it's like you see Leatherface running through the forest and he's got a chainsaw that's moving. There's a chain going around it, the smoke billowing out of it, and it's making this loud roaring sound, right? Versus somebody like chasing after somebody with like a machete. The difference is like night and day.
Yeah.
I mean,
even just the fact that even in the filmmaking that they didn't take the chain off.
They didn't. I mean, that blew my mind.
Like, that's insane to me. That when I heard that, using a real
chainsaw. Oh my gosh, this is definitely not a union production. Oh, I mean, like the fact that they actually had a live, and they mentioned this numerous times in one of the commentaries, that there was a live chain, cutting chain on this chainsaw, is mind blowing to me.
Yeah.
I mean, this means that you have a deadly weapon in the hands of, you know, or near several different actors through many
scenes. With a guy with a mask on that he can't see out of.
A guy with a mask on he can't see hardly out of. Running through a forest with a live chainsaw with a chain on it. I'm like, wow. You know, but even without and I guess it's like you don't need to be told that, right? When you see that chainsaw, I think it's pretty darn obvious in a lot of those shots that, I mean, this looks real. Like, it's, you know, like this looks and feels real. And I think all those little things add up. I mean, there are definitely scenes there. There are shots where you can see that chain moving. It's very clear that you can see it's a real chainsaw operating, you know. But I just feel like just that it's, again, it's so visceral. I mean, you know, it's, I think anybody who's been around tools, like, you respect a chainsaw.
Oh my god.
It's like you respect a chainsaw. That thing can make really quick work out of you It is in some ways it is like so much scarier than so many other weapons that might be used in a horror film.
Well, I always find that especially in horror, but just generally that makeshift weapons, you know, tools or whatever that aren't designed to kill or aren't designed to be weapons are always much more scary than something like a machete or a gun or a knife or something like
that. Especially a gun,
There's this element of like error that can be had, or that this thing isn't designed to kill, so it'll be slow and it'll be painful kind of.
Yep, and messy.
I do want to also discuss quickly the entire kind of sequence in the house with Sally, you know, getting dragged out for dinner and grandpa.
So
there's a bit of context that I think is important to technical context, which is that so the film was shot on 16mm, as we mentioned, but it was shot on a very low 25 ASA, which is basically just means that you need a lot of light to expose the film. And the reason they did that was so that when they did 35mm blow-ups for theatrical presentations, that the grain wouldn't be, you know, super blown
overwhelming,
up like on a lot of 16mm. So what that meant, though, is that, they needed a ton of light, and they didn't have a budget for a lot of light. So they had, I think he said, they had like 2 5Ks and 1 10K, which are basically not even that bright by today's standards, but were bright at the time. But those lights are also very hot.
There's this
really, I think, what kind of makes that whole, you know, what is it, like 15-minute sequence, is the fact that the guy playing Grandpa, I think they said he was like 18.
And then makeup.
And so his makeup took, I think, 10 hours to do. And so they did that. And after he did the makeup, he was like, you're going to finish me out today because I don't want to sit through that makeup process again. And so what happened was they wound up shooting, I think it was a 27-hour day of all of that dinner stuff.
Yep.
Just from, I think it was from, like he said, like noon to 3 in the afternoon the next day or something.
Right.
And so all through the night. And what you got to understand, if you've never worked on a film set, is that even today with like LEDs and modern lights and stuff, it still gets very hot when you just have a lot of people inside, especially in somewhere like Texas or, you know, if it's summer. And so they had this whole house closed off because, of course, most of that scene takes place at night. And the stories that they tell about how they were all just going crazier and crazier and crazier as this as the shoot went on, and how they kept trying. So the moment when he when Leatherface cuts Sally's finger to, you know, feed Grandpa, that they kept trying to do it. They had scotch tape over the knife blade and then a tube system so that Gunnar Hansen could squeeze out blood as he cut her. And what he realized, it was like take after take after take, it wasn't working, and so he just turned around and took the tape off the blade and actually cut her finger. So her reaction is real when she gets her finger cut there. And, you know, obviously that's not recommended
to do
on a film set, but you just have the, you know, all of them describing how they just were going completely insane, and how, again, Gunnar Hansen, because he was in full, you know, the full Leatherface get up and the suit and all that at that point, that he was so hot that his mind was just going beyond acting, where he, like, you know, by the 20th hour felt like he was actually supposed to kill her. And that there was a moment where when they get up to get Grandpa the hammer so that he can kill her, that Gunnar Hansen almost like dove at her and had to stop himself before realizing, oh, that's not the scene. But that was just the instinct, because he'd been acting like this character who had, you know, wanted to kill her for so long. And so I just find that, again, there's these tiny little elements that low budget can bring out in it. Like, you know, I wonder if they had, you know, if it was, again, fully supportive of all like film unions and all that, but I just wonder if this was a union set and there were rules around it. And
I don't think so.
And if they had money to do these things, how different the movie would feel.
I think it's clear. I mean, I think we've seen it would that the people have tried to replicate that feeling in so many ways. And I think that what you're hitting on is that, I mean, you know, to do this, you know, with $10 million and, you know, or more, and name actors or two, and, you know, 12-hour days tops, and, you know, all this kind of stuff, I think you don't get it. You know, I think you're right. It's like 27 hours or something. They're locked in this room. It's in Texas. It's in August. There's no air conditioning. Even if there were, you don't run it because it ruins the sound. you know, you've got these huge lights, you've got real meat sitting on the table that's mm-hmm. like rotting, you know, under these lights. You know, people are exhausted. They're practically heat stroked. I mean, it's like replicating exactly kind of the mindset you would really be in if you were in this situation. You're losing your mind. You know, you've transcended into some different mental space, some different physical space, you know, and that obviously impacted the film. I mean, it obviously impacted the performances, and you feel it. I think you feel those things when you're watching it. And I think it's just one more element. You know, again, I'll go back to visceral. I mean, it's just, you feel it. I feel like it's an actual experience. It's more than just watching. I think you actually viscerally experience it. I mean, it's just like this grandpa character. And, you know, and again, it's like we have basically a chainsaw and a hammer are like the weapons in this film, right? Yeah. And again, they're tools. But it's like where they're, you know, leaning her over that bucket, and you've got this like decrepit old man trying to like hit her in the head. I mean, and it's like a family event, you know, it's like carving the turkey, mm-hmm. you know, it's like on Thanksgiving and you've, you know, grandpa's there to cut the turkey and you're, you know, it's like a tradition and, you know, he's old and kind of feeble. So you're trying to like help hold his hand or something.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just.
Well, it's and like just the fact that they do hit her, and it's like you see her head split open, and she's just wailing, like she's screaming, and you just it's
horrible.
You can feel at that point completely hopeless. Like if you're wanting her to get away, you're just sitting there like there's no way she's getting out of this. You know, we're just watching this girl be killed by this wicked family, and then there's no greater feeling of like almost euphoria than when she jumps out that window and lands, and you're just like, oh god. And I think one of the funnier behind the scenes things too is that they all said that she was just the slowest runner, and so the reason why all the characters that are chasing her will do kind of zigzags, or like you'll see them sometimes just
so they
stop
don't catch up.
And that, like, I know the first time she's running around the house, that first nighttime chase scene when she like goes in and jumps out the second story window,
right,
that you see Leatherface come and sort of do this Looney Tunes like weird turn where he kind of has to screech and almost drift into the turn, and it's because they kept catching up to her too fast and you know, catching her, and kind of had to like play act what they do when they've caught
her. Even that worked because it's like the sense that you get, right? So it's like, here's the thing that happened in shooting. It's just like, well, our lead actress, the person who's being chased, is not a fast runner, so as fast as the people chasing her, so we got to make up for that somehow, right?
Yeah.
But what I see, this is the beauty of this kind of stuff, right? That these accidents can work out so well, but what I see are like these almost delirious characters like playing, toying like a cat with a mouse, right? Is what is the impression you get, like the goofy kind of zigzagging, right? It's like they're having fun. This is a game to them, and and which of course makes it even more just, you know, terrifying that they're just playing with her, because they're out in the middle of nowhere. They know she's not going anywhere. Where would she go? I think even that works. You know?
No, it's again, like, it's one of those things that the remakes really lost. Just this.
I've not seen many of them.
I know there was the Michael Bay one in 2004. Then they made a bunch of sequels off of that.
Yeah.
And then don't forget the second one. I think just last year they made like one of those kind of
reboots, like, or something,
or like it's like legacy sequels where they completely discarded all the other sequels and then it was a direct relation or direct sequel to this one.
I mean, I feel like I may have seen one or two of those other ones. I for sure absolutely have seen Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2, which is a completely different type of film than the first.
It's kind of like Gremlins versus Gremlins 2.
That's a really great analogy. But I think it's actually a really fun film. Tobe Hooper also directed that. It's like, I think, 12 or so years later. I have heard that, you know, that Tobe felt like the studio kind of took the film away from him, I think, at the end, I've heard, and kind of turned it into, you know, or they didn't give him enough time, or they weren't done shooting some of the sequences in full, and they took it away. So, you know, I think he has said that it's not his vision 100% that's on screen, but I think it's a really fun film. I mean, it's a completely different kind of film. It's you'd mentioned that there's humor in this first film. I mean, this film goes, you know, Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2 goes like full bore into yes. that, like over.
Well,
I
actually, there are a lot of elements I really find that are just great in it, like the fact that the hitchhiker character comes back with just, you know, it's one of those things where they just put like a plate metal on mm-hmm. his head, like that's yep. fixed him up, and just, you know, that's kind of an indication of how the second film treats the genre that it's in, where it's just very kind of gag filled.
I mean, I think all you need to know is that the release poster was a parody of The Breakfast Club and has the family is posed like The Breakfast Club. So, I mean, I think, you know, and it's got Dennis Hopper in it. I mean, come on, you know, but this isn't about Chainsaw 2. It's about Chainsaw, but that is a fun film. And I do recommend that. Yeah, you're right. Michael Bay produced the 2006 film, The Texas Chainsaw Massacre, The Beginning. I have not seen that. There's been like a Texas Chainsaw Massacre 3D. I haven't seen that. There's like one called Leatherface. I haven't seen that. I mean, I don't know.
I've seen all the original quadrilogy. I've seen 1, 2, 3, and then the Next Generation, I think the fourth one is called. I've seen that one, and that one's very goofy.
But clearly, you know, regardless of all of these kind of sequels or remakes or reboots or whatever the hell, you know, obviously Chainsaw lives on and has permeated the culture. You'd be hard pressed to find somebody, I think, who hadn't heard of it. It's an extremely effective film. And, you know, you could say I don't like horror or this isn't my cup of tea, and I would completely respect that. This is certainly... I would, you know, I'm sure there are many people that this kind of film would not be their cup of tea. But the thing that you cannot argue is how effective this film is. Mm-hmm. And you talked about, you know, that there were some shots that weren't like, you know, highly technical or that it, but I, there were a few that stood out to me. You'd mentioned there's a shot where they kind of go underneath a swing as a character rises from a swing. We go under this porch swing or this like long swing, bench swing, and follow her to the house where the house is like, we have a wide angle lens and the house just grows until it's overtaking the frame. That's beautiful. And some of them are really simple. There's a beautiful shot where the man from the gas station, who ends up, of course, being part of the family, where the woman runs into the gas station to escape Leatherface, only, of course, to, you know, fall out of the frying pan into the fire, which we don't know yet, but we'll soon find out. Where he puts her into the truck, we've got this like beautiful push in or mm-hmm. dolly into the truck from the opposite side, where we see him put her into the truck, and then we pull back as he comes around and enters into the cab. It's very simple but so effective. I mean, mm-hmm. it's a really beautiful shot, beautifully timed. It's well done.
The night photography is also very impressive, considering the stock we're filming on.
It
and
really
the
is
limit of lights. Yeah, the
it really is, and I think this is something we lose with some digital photography today's day and age, because modern digital cameras are so light sensitive, mm-hmm. and you can see everything clearly in a lot of night, unless of course you work to not make that happen. Mm-hmm. But in a lot of night photography, I mean, you can shoot like full blown middle of the night and see everything.
Yeah, just from moonlight very frequently too. Yeah,
you see everything, and I love this grainy, distorted kind of, because it's kind of like the way we see. Like if you're running around in the dark, that fuzzy kind of grainy. It's like mimics how our eye, at least my eyes, I've never seen through anyone else's eyes, so I don't know. But that's how I see if it's really dark, right? It's like fuzzy and you kind of have this noise in your vision and you can't quite make everything out. So extremely effective. Mm-hmm. And I just wanted to say, you know, because I haven't seen every film in the world, that's impossible. So I'm not quite sure, but this has got to be one of the first films that's got like the last girl, right? That survives till the end. This has got to be one of the first, or at least mm-hmm. one of the more successful, where we have, you know, the final girl who survives and you've got that just beautiful couple shots, you know, where she hops in the truck.
Oh, those are, yeah, fantastic shots.
And I mean, it's really great. We've got this, there are actually a lot of really nice shots. There's some beautiful wides of the van driving across the landscape. There's this beautiful tense shot of her trying to climb in the bed of the truck at the very end with Leatherface chasing after her. And I love that they just keep it in this wide shot. So many films just overdo it. There'd be like 6, 7, 8 cuts or something.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And different angles and, you know, reverses and all this. No, just this wide shot. You can see him closing. She's trying to climb up the wheel. Boom. She gets in the bed of the truck.
He swipes her.
Yes. It does. It looks like he like hit her almost. And you're like, whoa.
And the inserts are also really spectacular in this film too. Like just all the, just especially inside the house where it'll like pan over from, you know, Sally in the chair and just zoom in on a skull and focus on the skull for a moment. Like those types of things are really, really well done. Yeah. It's a marvel what they did with such low.
Here we are. It's like, can you tell we like this film? I feel like we just devolve into like, but what about that scene? What about that scene? That scene was great. I think, you know, this established or really reinforced a lot of these tropes. You've got the final girl and just such a beautiful finale to the film where, you know, she's just totally out of her skull, right? Mm-hmm. In the bed of this truck after what she's gone through, drenched in blood. And we see, you know, we see her in the bed of the truck, beautiful reverse, moving away from Leatherface. And then just this like wild, crazy, like, you know, dance with the chainsaw in the sunset is just.
It's like temper tantrum.
Or just like some wild. It doesn't even feel like a temper tantrum to me. It just feels like some almost like wild, like dance of like. Ecstasy and death or something, you know, it's almost just like, I could imagine Herzog doing something like this, you know, it's like, it's just almost like one of those
flaring on the lens as it
like landscape of the soul, but of like the darkest side of the skull. Soul, you know, is almost what I feel like. There you go.
And then it just cuts off. I mean, that's what's incredible is that the movie just boom to credits.
You know, and we really didn't touch on that, but something that I just kind of want to bring up a little bit before we finish here is that editing. There were so many moments in this film. You know, I think in today's day and age, editors have gotten to a place where, with rare exception, they're trying to hide every cut. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, cutting on motion, like matching everything, where it's just this such a smooth transition from cut to cut that you literally don't even recognize that it's happening. You know, it's just... It's just smooth as butter.
Mm-hmm.
And so many of these cuts here in this film are the exact opposite of that. It's almost like in music where instead of like coming right in on the beat, which is what I think most editors do today. And I think, you know, this is a pretty good analogy that the editing really is about rhythm and it's almost like a musicality to it. But I feel like so many of the cuts here in this film are like just ahead of the beat or just after the beat.
Well, there's a really interesting one too that it's clearly just a really, really good decision where when they get to the graveyard and there's that guy laying down on the ground and he's kind of like talking for a minute.
In the old tire.
And he's talking and this shot is like over his head kind of.
Right.
And he inhales and it cuts between his inhales. So you don't ever, like, it's this really weird subconscious feeling of not getting to see that exhale that makes you sort of on edge and uncomfortable.
There's no resolution. It adds to that tension. And there are numerous cuts that way where it's like not quite on the movement or like right before or right after.
Or sometimes double. Like I think when Leatherface first hits the first victim, I'm forgetting all their names, but, it almost feels like there's a really quick double cut of like boom boom like as he goes down, like it's the cut of Leatherface and then a wide and it's like that you almost see the hit twice and it makes it just all the more like
impactful,
startling and shocking.
I mean clearly we both are fascinated with this film. I think it's you know, especially if you're a student of filmmaking or you're an independent filmmaker, even if you're not looking to make a horror film, I think this film has some really powerful examples of how to make an effective film on a shoestring budget. Mm-hmm. I just, you know, it's interesting to me just real quickly before we wrap up here, you know, that Toby had such success with this film and so early in his career. I mean, I think this is maybe the third film that he had made. And I think, you know, he'd done like a documentary film before that about Peter, Paul and Mary. And he had done this small film called Eggshells in 69. And it's interesting to me that although, yes, he definitely made other films, and he made films all the way up until 2013. And he also directed some television, although not a ton, maybe a dozen episodes or so of some random things. I mean, aside from Poltergeist, I'm not aware of anything he did that really ever got any significant traction anymore, mm-hmm. you know, after that, which is, you know, always kind of interesting to me, you know, when filmmakers have such a huge impact with a film, but then don't seem to really push through with anything else. And of course, not that we'll go into Poltergeist a ton, but that's also a superb film from 1982, I think, superb mm-hmm. film, mm-hmm. Much more commercial mainstream studio film, than Texas Chainsaw Massacre. And there's some like weird controversy, you know, Spielberg produced this film. There's been some people trying to say, I think here and there, maybe still Spielberg directed it, which was probably really frustrating to Toby, I would imagine. Mm-hmm. But I don't know. It's just interesting to me that he was able to do so much with so little with Chainsaw, but just never seemed to replicate that anywhere else.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, it's so, definitely, I've always been, I mean, there's multiple cases like that in Hollywood or in film in general, and I always find those very fascinating.
Well, it makes me wonder, you know, if it's kind of just this, obviously we're hypothesizing, we're not there, we don't know, a million things could be true, and again, I'm certainly not knocking Toby as a talent or anything, but maybe there is, you know, maybe it kind of speaks to some of that credence about, you know, more money, more structure, more people, more gear, doesn't necessarily equal better film,
better quality.
You know, it almost makes you wonder if he had gone back and tried to make an 80,000. I mean, he definitely did make some low budget films, but it almost makes you wonder, you know, if you like lose the ability to make films like that. So DIY, mm-hmm. yeah. What could have been if he would have had other situations like that. All right. Well, I think that wraps it up for mm-hmm. Texas Chainsaw Massacre. Can I just say one other thing?
Absolutely.
Just one last thing. Yeah. Oh, man. So this has almost nothing to do with anything, but I just want to tell the story. So thinking of it now, I was talking about the chainsaw and what a superb, like, visceral weapon I feel like that is, just on, like, a primal level, you know, that it's like this, it's like a almost like a living, breathing thing itself. You know, it's this machine. Mm-hmm. It burns fuel. It breathes air. It exhales smoke. It moves. It vibrates. It makes this sound. Have you ever been to a haunted house where they
have a
chainless chainsaw and a guy like running around there is no way that you can't be terrified of that, even when you know there's no
there's
chain
no,
on it.
Yeah,
there is
yeah.
no way. I remember the first time that ever happened to me, and I damn near crapped my pants.
Mm-hmm.
The first time that ever happened to me as a kid, I was at a haunted house, and at the end of the haunted house, there was like a guy waiting.
They're always, you know, in like the bushes or something. Yeah.
Like at the exit. At the exit. And he came after me, and it was like a real gas chainsaw. So it was mm-hmm. and ran after me. And I have never run faster in my life.
Oh, yeah.
So anyway, on that note. All right, Cullen. Well, I'm so glad to be back on the saddle on the podcast with you. I look forward to your choice for next time. But until then, everybody, thanks for listening. We hope you enjoyed, and we'll catch you next time.
Yeah, thank you.